Well, welcome everybody to the reading on the synthesis of yoga at Infinite Conversations. We were on chapter 10, the three modes of nature, and we have a new person joining us for the reading. So how about if we start that chapter over from the beginning? And yeah. So for the reading order, how about Jeffrey, Andrea, John Robert, and Radhika in that order? Does that work for everybody?
Yeah.
Okay. And so Radhika, what we do is we read roughly one paragraph at each and then pass it on.
Okay.
So, chapter 10, the three modes of nature. Can you hear me fine?
Yes.
Okay. To transcend the natural action of the lower prakriti is indispensable to the soul if it is to be free of itself and free in its works. Harmonious subjection to this actual universal nature, a condition of good and perfect work for the natural instruments, is not an ideal for the soul, which should rather be subject to God and his Shakti, but master of its own nature. As agent or as channel of the supreme will, it must determine by its vision and sanction or refusal the use that shall be made of the storage of energy, the conditions of environment, the rhythm of combined movement, which are provided by prakriti for the labor of the natural instruments, mind, life, and body. But this inferior nature can only be mastered if she is surmounted and used from above. And this can only be done by a transcendence of her forces, qualities, and modes of action. Otherwise, we are subject to her conditions and helplessly dominated by her, not free in the spirit. I'm kind of glad we're rereading this because I have no memory of that paragraph.
The idea of the three essential modes of nature is a creation of the ancient Indian thinkers, and its truth is not because it was the result of long cycles. Experiment and profound internal experience. Therefore, without a long inner experience, without intimate self-observation and intuitive perception of the nature forces, it is difficult to grasp accurately or firmly utilize. Still, certain broad indications may help the seeker on the way of works to understand, analyze, and control by his assent or refusal, the combinations of his own nature. These modes are termed in the Indian books qualities gunas and are given the names sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is the force of equilibrium and translates in quality as good and harmony, as good and harmony and happiness and light. Rajas is the force of kinesis and translates in quality as struggle and effort, passion and action. Tamas is the force of inconscience and inertia and translates in quality as obscurity and incapacity and inaction. Ordinarily used for psychological self-analysis, these distinctions are valid also in physical nature. Each thing and every existence in the lower prakriti contains them, and its process and dynamic form are the result of the interaction of these qualitative powers.
Every form of things, whether animate or inanimate, is a constantly maintained poise of natural forces in motion and is subject to an unending stream of helpful, disturbing, or disintegrating contacts from other combinations of forces that surround it. our own nature of mind, life, and body is nothing else than such a formative combination and poise. In the reception of the environing contacts and the reaction to them, the three modes determine the temper of the recipient and the character of the response. Inert and inept, he may suffer them without any responsive reaction, any motion of self-defense, or any capacity of assimilation and adjustment. This is the mode of tamas, the way of inertia. The stigmata of tamas are blindness and unconsciousness and incapacity and unintelligence, sloth and indolence and inactivity and mechanical routine and the mind's torpor and the life's sleep and the soul's slumber. Its effect, if uncorrected by other elements, can be nothing but disintegration of the form or the poise of the nature without any new creation or new equilibrium or force of kinetic progress. At the heart of this inert omnipotence is the principle of ignorance and an inability or slothful unwillingness to comprehend, seize, and manage the stimulating or assailing contact, the suggestion of environing forces, and their urge towards fresh experience.
On the other hand, the recipient of nature's contacts, touched and stimulated, solicited or assailed by her forces, may react to the pressure or against it. She allows, encourages, impels him to strive, to resist, to attempt, to dominate or engross his environment, to assert his will, to fight and create and conquer. This is the mode of Rajas, the way of passion and action and the thirst of desire. Struggle and change and new creation, victory and defeat and joy and suffering and hope and disappointment are its children, and build the many-colored house of life in which it takes its pleasure. But its knowledge is an imperfect or a false knowledge and brings with it ignorant effort, error, a constant misadjustment, pain of attachment, disappointed desire, grief of loss and failure. The gift of Rajas is kinetic force, energy, activity, the power that creates and acts and can overcome. But it moves in the wrong lights or the half lights of the ignorance, and it is perverted by the touch of the asura, rakshasa, and pishacha. The arrogant ignorance of the human mind and its self-satisfied perversions and presumptuous errors, the pride and vanity and ambition, the cruelty and tyranny and beast wrath and violence, the selfishness and baseness and hypocrisy and treachery and vile meanness, the lust and greed and rapacity, the jealousy, envy, and bottomless ingratitude that disfigure the earth nature are the natural children of this indispensable but strong and dangerous turn of nature.
But the embodied being is not limited to these two modes of prakriti. There is a better and more enlightened way in which he can deal with surrounding impacts and the stream of the world forces. There is possible a reception and reaction with clear comprehension, poise, and balance. And her ways. It has an intelligence that penetrates her processes and her significances and can assimilate and utilize. There is a lucid response that is not overpowered, but adjusts, corrects, adapts, harmonizes, elicits the best in all things. This is the mode of sattva, the turn of nature that is full of light and pause, directed to good, to knowledge, to delight and beauty, to happiness, right understanding, right equilibrium, right order. Its temperament is the opulence of a bright clearness of knowledge and a lucent warmth of sympathy and closeness, a fineness and enlightenment, a governed energy, an accomplished harmony, and poise of the whole being is the consummate sattvic nature.
Can we discuss?
No existence is cast entirely.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, like, I had some questions.
Yeah.
So he keeps using the word poise, P-O-I-S-E, and like at one point he says we are all a combination, let me pull up the page. He says we are a constant, every form of things is a poise of natural forces in motion, and we are subject to an unending stream of contacts from other combinations of forces. So like, what do you mean by the word, like in this context, what does the word poise mean? And how does this poise, it's the difference in the poise that is the difference in the gunas, is that what he's saying?
Well, actually, I think what he's saying is that the poise is the balance of these three forces, these three gunas. So no person has all just one. We all have a mixture of them. And they're, since they operate in different ways, they create a certain balance. For some people, the balance is more sattvic. For other people, the balance is more rajastic. For other people, it might be more tamasic. But it's a kind of the interaction and the balance between these different forces that for example will give us a particular kind of character in a person's nature.
And what does he mean by temperament? Like he says at several times, he says the character of the response to the forces. See, he says that this poise determines. I'm trying to find the sentence.
Okay.
He says in the reception of the environing contacts and the reaction to them, the three modes determine the temper of the recipient and the character of the response. I kind of want to understand this line more. So it's like on page 233 in the second paragraph.
Okay.
In the reception of the environing contacts and the reaction to them, the three modes. So what does it mean, temper of the recipient and character of the response? Like I thought temper just means like you have a bad temper, like you lose your temper. So what does it mean?
No,
oh, okay.
No. Temper means the way one sits in one's person. It's kind of an explanation of how one is, sits inside who one is the temper of a person.
Give me an example.
So it doesn't have to mean anger.
It's more like your nature, your regular nature, the way you respond to the world. That is your temper.
Okay.
So for example,
your temperament.
Okay, so it just means temperament.
Yeah, for example.
Kind of. Yeah, it's close to
steel has a certain temper and it can be brittle, a really strong and brittle, or it can be flexible. That's its temper. It's like it's the way that it's constituted, and as a result, the way that it reacts to contact and to forces that touch it or press it.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, steel has a certain temper, and water has a certain temper, which is very different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there something else, Radhika?
No, I mean, and he says character of the response. So, like, is he just saying that we are always in the middle of forces and we are always reacting to them, but what governs our response is this fundamental temper. And when he says character of the response, so does that just mean why does he say character of the response?
The quality of the response, the type of the response. That's all he means there.
Okay, you can respond like with force, with violence, with intelligence, and I'm guessing, okay.
Exactly.
So we've lost you. Comes and goes.
On my end, it's okay.
I can hear her, Jeffrey Chen.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So you're actually your internet.
Oh, you your heard internet. Her the whole time.
Yeah, I heard everything she said. Your internet is coming in and out.
Okay.
Andrea, yours and your internet is coming in and out. So you fade out and freeze, and then you come back. So I think that's what's happening, that you're not hearing everything.
Okay, so it's that's the problem.
Yeah.
Now I've got.
Yeah, I need to go and get my cord out of the suitcase, which is still in the car. I'll be back.
Okay.
John, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, so like I have like certain practical questions. So he says that there are all these forces, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, so let's say somehow you end up in this place where there are a lot of antagonistic forces, forces that are fundamentally antagonistic to your temperament.
Okay.
In that case, how do you respond? Do you respond with rajas? Is it when you're faced with something antagonistic?
Well, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is if you haven't evolved so that your soul comes forward, and he says most of the time we're just operating out of our nature. We think we're free. We think we are independent and all that, but it's a lot of that is an illusion that we're actually operating from our nature, and that's from these three gunas that he's talking about. So an individual who's in an environment that's antagonistic will, if they haven't done a lot of work on themselves, if they haven't evolved, will respond according to the combination of these three gunas that they have. So if a person is sattvic, if the person is mostly sattvic, they will respond in that way. If the person is tamasic, they'll probably respond mostly in that way, withdrawal or just being, you know, accept being defeated and lying down and not fighting back. If a person has more rajas in them, then there will be a lot more energetic response to the hostility in the situation.
But what is the ideal response? So you have to get free of all the three gunas, and but then like my question is, the minute you act according to one of the three modes of nature. Like all action is governed by the three modes of nature. So once you decide to act, you can only act either tamasically or sattvically or rajasically.
Well, it'll probably be a combination, some combination, but one of them will be stronger, or maybe two of them will be stronger. There's all different kinds of combinations of these three forces, of these three modes, I should say.
I'm asking this because like throughout my life, like I've often been thrown into circumstances or situations where like I am the odd one out and I have to face like lots of people who are hostile to me. And even ever since I was a child, like a teenager in high school, I was bullied in high school. Looking back, I can see that I've always had someone who is my nemesis or an antagonist, and I have to deal with that. But my question is, like, how do you deal with that? Like, just go for it, like really just fight back, or do you just quit? Or because I've tried all three. I've tried being tamasic and walking away. I've tried fighting back. I don't know what the sattvic response is, but like, that's why I'm asking this question. It's based on my own life.
Well, I think Sri Aurobindo is going to help answer some of that as we go along in this chapter. So how about if we read some more, he's going to describe what the sattvic person is like and see if that, you know, if that gives you some guidance. I think right now he's not really saying this is what you need to do. He's just saying this is a way to look at it, but he hasn't given us much in what to do about it yet.
No, actually, I was thinking that a sattvic person would manage their life in such a way that they never confront anything antagonistic. Like that was what occurred to me, that perhaps a sattvic person would never be in that situation in the first place.
Well, I doubt if a sattvic person could avoid all of those situations, and sattvic person has some balance and some light in his nature that helps him to deal with that kind of thing.
So they will have to face it, just the response is different.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, every person's life is different, but usually I think everybody, most people will wind up having to face that kind of thing sooner or later, maybe often, maybe not so often. So,
we're having trouble getting a better line. It's a bit because it's an odd thing. It's just the way that things are worked out. The text is in one place, and the link is another place, and the link is piggybacking off my phone, and it's not working very well. So,
can you hear us clearly?
Yeah, I can hear you.
I heard what you said that time, but your image sometimes freezes and sometimes your voice goes away.
Okay.
Well, maybe we could turn off the video. That might help.
Okay, we'll turn off the video. And now we need to find the text again.
Yeah.
We're all the way in the beginning. Okay, it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Voila. Okay. No existence is cast entirely in the single mold of any of these three modes of the cosmic force. All three are present in everyone and everywhere. There is a constant combining and separation of their shifting relations and interpenetrating influences, often a conflict, a wrestling of forces, a struggle to dominate each other. All have, in great or in small extent or degree, even if sometimes in a hardly appreciable minimum, their sattvic states and clear tracts or inchoate tendencies of light and happiness, fine adaptation and sympathy with the environment, intelligence, poise, right mind, right will and feeling, right impulse, virtue, order. All have their rajasic moods and impulses and turbid parts of desire and passion and struggle, perversion and falsehood and error, unbalanced joy and sorrow, aggressive push to work and eager creation, and strong or bold or fiery or fierce reactions to the pressure of the environment and to life's assaults and offers. all have their tamasic states and constant obscure parts, their moments or points of unconsciousness, their long habit or their temporary velleities of weak resignation or dull acceptance, their constitutional feebleness or movements of fatigue, negligence and indolence, and their lapses into ignorance and incapacity, depression and fear, and cowardly recoil or submission to the environment and to the pressure of men and events and forces. Each one of us is sattvic in some directions of his energy of nature, or in some parts of his mind or character, in others rajasic, tamasic in others. According as one or other of the modes usually dominates his temperament, type of mind and turn of action, it is said of him that he few are always of one kind and none is entire in his kind. The wise are not always or wholly wise. The intelligent are intelligent only in patches. The sane suppresses in himself many unsaintly movements, and the evil are not entirely evil. The dullest has his unexpressed or unused and undeveloped capacities. The most timorous has moments or his way of courage. The helpless and the weakling a latent part of strength in his nature. The dominant gunas are not the essential soul type of the embodied being, but only the index of the formation he has made for his life or during his present existence and at a given moment of his evolution in time.
Radhika, when we come to a break like that, like this, sometimes we stop and say, does anybody have anything they want to say before we go on reading?
Okay, yeah, sure. I don't have any question right now.
Okay.
No, but I really like that part. I really like that last paragraph. It was interesting. This sort of mixtures.
Mm-hmm. When the sadhaka has once stood back from the action of prakriti within him or upon him, and not interfering, not amending or inhibiting, not choosing or deciding, allowed its play and analyzed and watched the process, he soon discovers that her modes are self-dependent and work as a machine once put in action works by its own structure and propelling forces. The force and the propulsion come from prakriti and not from the creature. Then he realizes how mistaken was his impression that his mind was the doer of his works. His mind was only a small part of him and a creation and engine of nature. Nature was acting all the while in her own modes, moving the three general qualities about as a girl might play with her puppets. His ego was all along a tool and plaything. His character and intelligence, his moral qualities and mental powers, his creations and works and exploits, his anger and forbearance, his cruelty and mercy, his love and his hatred, his sin and his virtue, his light and his darkness, his passion of joy and his anguish of sorrow, were the play of nature to which the soul, attracted, won, and subjected, lent its passive concurrence. And yet, the determinism of nature or force is not all. The soul has a word to say in the matter. But the secret soul, the Purusha, not the mind or the ego, since these are not independent entities, they are parts of nature. For the soul's sanction is needed for the play, and by an inner silent will, as the Lord and giver of the sanction, it can determine the principle of the play and intervene in its combinations. Although the execution in thought and will and act and impulse must still be nature's part and privilege. The Purusha can dictate a harmony for nature to execute, not by interfering in her functions, but by a conscious regard on her, which she transmutes at once, or after much difficulty, into translating idea and dynamic impetus and significant figure.
Shall we stop there? And
sure.
That's a very heavy paragraph.
Okay. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
What would you like?
What I want to know is, so he says the force and the propulsion come from Prakriti and not creature.
Right.
He realizes how mistaken was his impression that his mind was the doer of his works. So let's say you go to, I'm in a new country. So I come to this new country, I meet all these people. Some people I really like, I talk to them a lot. Other people I do not like, I stay away from them. Other people I hate and I fight with them. How is this nature acting in me and not my own mind? Like when I respond to someone with a feeling of sympathy or a feeling of antagonism, is it not my mind that's deciding? Why does he say that Prakriti is acting in my mind?
He's saying that when you act from those in those three situations, that what's really acting, it looks like to the individual, it looks like, yeah, I'm doing this. It's obvious that I'm doing this. But he says it's not. That's not really what happens. And one finds that out when one steps back and becomes a witness of it. And then he says one sees that it's more like a kind of a mechanical operation of nature. So he's saying that when we operate this way and we think it's really ourself, he says we're operating in ignorance. We're not yet at the point where we see what's really going on, even though that's the way it seems to us.
Is he saying that I'm enacting a pre-written script? Like when my force meets a certain corresponding force, a certain script plays out on its own because of nature?
Yeah, I think that's one way to say it.
So then he says, and yet the determinism of nature or force is not all. The soul has a word to say in the matter, but the secret soul, the Purusha, not the mind or the ego, since these are not independent entities. For the soul's sanction is needed for the play, and by an inner silent will, as the lord and giver of the sanction, it can determine the principle of the play and intervene in its combinations. Although the execution in thought and will and act and impulse must still be nature's part and privilege. So like that last sentence, for the soul's sanction is needed. And then he says that it determines the principle of the play and the combinations. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? What is this distinction between soul's sanction and nature's execution? So,
Andrea or Jeffrey Jen, would you like to come into the conversation?
I have no idea personally. I mean, I'm relying on you guys. So,
okay.
Sorry.
And I had to step away for a moment, so I haven't been present for the last.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk some more about this. I just didn't want to leave you guys out. Mother said at one point that when we're born, it's like we dropped on our heads and we forget where we came from and who we really are.
And then we
learn from our parents and our family and the surrounding environment And often, at least certainly in my case, you know, these weren't people who had advanced a long way on in terms of consciousness. So we learn and really in deep ways certain ways of thinking about ourselves. And Sri Aurobindo is offering a spiritual way, which is not what I learned and not what probably most of us learned. And he says that actually what happened when the soul came in, when my soul came in, for example, I forgot where I came from. And so I just assumed that what was happening through me was me. And Sri Aurobindo is saying that's not the case. But he's saying that the soul still agreed to this. That's the soul's sanction. The soul agreed to come into this life under the conditions that it is, not under some special conditions that this is the life that we have right now. And so the soul sanctions that. That's like a play by which the soul gradually learns that it's kind of encased in nature, and that's not really who it is. Soul's not really nature. Soul is a conscious person. And when a person sets out on a spiritual path, one of the first things they do is to step into a mode of consciousness called a witness. And he's talking about that when he talks about the conscious regard that the Purusha can kind of watch what's going on in its own being, in its nature. So like in meditation, for example, you kind of step back and you see all this stuff going on. You think, holy cow, look at all this that's happening. And after a while, you'll see these kind of patterns that just repeat over and over and over and over, like a computer program or something. And he says that as the soul gets stronger, he says the Purusha can dictate a harmony for nature to execute, not by interfering, but by a conscious regard. I think that's really profound. A conscious regard.
That word, like, what does it mean? Conscious regard. Like, I was also struck by those two words. He says the soul casts a conscious regard on nature, but does not interfere in her functions. So
there's something about really being seen. Really being heard, which is another mode of it, that brings new consciousness to the being. And gradually, this soul that first of all is only a witness begins to realize, oh, I have a sanction. I can, right now I've been kind of sanctioning all of this automatically, but now I can say, okay, I want this play of my nature to go in this direction or in that direction. And just by the regard of it, I imagine the regard as being not only full of conscious light, but also of compassion and love. And that in itself, pardon?
It's a very interesting choice of word, regard. He says regard, like that's a very nice word. It's a beautiful word.
So I think that's where he's taking us here. But usually when we have a bunch of questions, Sri Aurobindo answers them in the next paragraph or two. So shall we go on and see what he says next?
Whose turn is it to read? Is it mine?
I think it's yours.
Okay. An escape from the action of the two inferior gunas is very evidently indispensable if we are to transmute our present nature into a power and form of the divine consciousness and an instrument of its forces. Tamas obscures and prevents the light of the divine knowledge from penetrating into the dark and dull corners of our nature. Tamas incapacitates and takes away the power to respond to divine impulse and the energy to change and the will to progress and make ourselves plastic to a greater Shakti. Rajas perverts knowledge, makes our reason the accomplice of falsehood, and the abettor of every wrong movement, disturbs and twists our life force and its impulses, oversets the balance and health of the body. Rajas captures all high-born ideas and high-seated movements and turns them to a false, egoistic use. Even divine truth and divine influences, when they descend into the earthly plane, cannot escape this misuse and seizure. Tamas unenlightened and Rajas unconverted, no divine change or divine life is possible.
An exclusive resort to sattva would seem to be the way of escape, but there is this difficulty that no one of the qualities can prevail by itself against its two companions and rivals. If envisaging the quality of desire and passion as the cause of disturbance, suffering, and sorrow, Rajas sinks, but tamas rises. For the principle of activity dulled, it takes right sentiment, can be founded by the principle of light. But if Rajas is absent or completely suppressed, the quiet in the soul tends to become a tranquility of inaction, not the firm ground of a dynamic change. In effectively right thinking, the nature may become in its dynamic parts sattva tamasic, neutral, pale-tinted, uncreative, or empty to power. Total obscurity may be, and this is a hampering limitation and another kind of incompetence. For tamas is a double principle. It contradicts rajas by inertia. It contradicts sattva by narrowness, obscurity, and ignorance. And if either is depressed, it pours in to occupy its place.
If we call in Rajas again to correct this error and bid it ally itself to sattva, and by their united agency endeavor to get rid of the dark principle, we find that we have elevated our action, but that there is again subjection to rajasic eagerness, passion, disappointment, suffering. These movements may be more exalted in their scope and spirit and action than before, but they are not the peace, the freedom, or the self-mastery, which, wherever there an ego harbor, passion and disturbance harbor with them and share their life. And if we seek a compromise between the three modes, sattva leading, the other coordinate, still we have arrived at a more temperate action of the play of nature. Spiritual freedom and mastery are not in sight, or else are still only a far-off prospect.
A radically different movement has to draw us back from the gunas and lift us above them. The error that accepts the action of the modes of nature must cease. For as long as it is accepted, the soul is involved in their operations and subjected to their law. Sattva must be transcended, as well as Rajas and Tamas. The golden chain must be broken no less than the leaden fetters and the bond ornaments of mixed alloy. The Gita prescribes to this end a new method of self-discipline. It is to stand back in oneself from the action of the modes and observe this unsteady flux as the witness seated above the surge of the forces of nature. He is the one who watches but is impartial and indifferent, aloof from them on their own level and in his native posture high above them. As they rise and fall in their waves, the witness looks, observes, but neither accepts nor, for the moment, interferes with their course. First, there must be the freedom of the impersonal witness. Afterwards, there can be the control of the master, the Ishwara.
Do you want me to continue or should we stop?
Let's see if anybody has anything to say here, and then if nobody does, you can continue.
Okay, I'll continue.
Okay.
The initial advantage of this process of detachment is that one begins to understand one's own nature and all nature. The detached witness is able to see entirely, without the least blinding by egoism, the play of her modes of the ignorance and to pursue it into all its ramifications, coverings and subtleties, for it is full of camouflage and disguise and snare and treachery and ruse. Instructed by long experience, conscious of all act and condition as their interaction, made wise of their processes, he cannot any longer be overcome by their assaults, surprised in their nets or deceived by their disguises. At the same time, he perceives the ego to be nothing better than a device and the sustaining knot of their interaction, and perceiving it, he is delivered from the illusion of the lower egoistic nature. He escapes from the sattvic egoism of the altruist and the saint and the thinker. He shakes off from its control on his life impulses the rajasic egoism of the self-seeker and ceases to be the laborious caterer of self-interest and the pampered prisoner or toiling galley slave of passion and desire. He slays with the light of knowledge the tamasic egoism of the ignorant of passive being, dull, unintelligent, attached to the common round of human life. Thus convinced and conscious of the essential vice of the ego sense in all our personal action, he seeks no longer to find a means of self-correction and self-liberation in the rajasic or sattvic ego, but looks above, beyond the instruments and the working of nature, to the master of works alone and his supreme shakti, the supreme prakriti. There alone, all the being is pure and free and the rule of a divine truth is possible.
In this progression, the first step is a certain detached superiority to the three modes of nature. The soul is inwardly separated and free from the lower prakriti, not involved in its coils, indifferent and glad above it. Nature continues to act in the triple round of her ancient habits. Desire, grief, and joy attack the heart. The instruments fall into inaction and obscurity and weirdness. Light and peace come back into the heart and mind and body, but the soul stands unchanged and untouched by observing and unmoved by the grief and desire of the lower members, smiling at their joys and their strainings, regard overpowered by the and the wildness or the weak that serves, uncompelled and unattached the mind nations and sense of ease or of power in the return of light and gladness. It throws higher will and the of a greater luminous knowledge. Thus, we're back.
Okay.
Can you hear us?
Yeah, now I can. There was silence there for quite a while. And again, your audio is coming in and out. It's not steady.